Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, January 16, 2023. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 Eastern. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. You can also support us by purchasing the books, Government by Consent and Court Access and the Common Law. You can find them also on the right-hand side of our website. Also, join our campaign for constitutional sheriffs, also found on the right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week with our scripture reading. We're in the Gospel of Romans. No, we're in the book of Romans. I don't think I set the book up, so let me set the book up so we can get it open. Okay, let's see. Romans chapter... What chapter are we in? I think we're on Romans 15. Okay, I got it. All right, Romans chapter 15, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 15. We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak, and not to please ourselves. Let every one of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. For even Christ pleased not himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of them that reproached thee fell on me. For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Now the God of patience and consolation grant you to be like-minded one toward another, according to Christ Jesus, that ye may with one mind and one mouth glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Wherefore, receive ye one another, as Christ also received us to the glory of God. Now I say, that Jesus Christ was a minister of the circumcision for the truth of God, to confirm the promises made unto the fathers, and that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy. As it is written, For this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles, and sing unto thy name. And again he saith, Rejoice, ye Gentiles, with his people. And again, Praise the Lord, all ye Gentiles, and laud him, all ye people. And again, Isaiah saith, There shall be a root of Jesse, and he that shall rise to reign over the Gentiles. In him shall the Gentiles trust. Now the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that ye may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Ghost. And I myself also am persuaded of you, my brethren, that ye also are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able also to admonish one another. Nevertheless, brethren, I have written the more boldly unto you in some sort, as putting you in mind, because of the grace that is given to me of God, that I should be the minister of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles, ministering the gospel of God, that the offering up of the Gentiles might be acceptable, being sanctified by the Holy Ghost. I have, therefore, whereof I may glory through Jesus Christ in those things which pertain to God. For I will not dare to speak of any of those things which Christ hath not wrought by me to make the Gentiles obedient by word and deed, through mighty signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God. So that from Jerusalem and round about unto Illyricum I have fully preached the gospel of Christ. Yea, so have I strived to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build upon another man's foundation. But as it is written, to whom he was not spoken of, they shall see, and they that have not heard shall understand. For which cause also I have been much hindered from coming to you. But now, having no more place in these parts, and having a great desire these many years to come unto you, whensoever I take my journey into Spain, I will come to you. For I trust to see you in my journey, and to be brought on my way thitherward by you, if first I be somewhat filled with your company. But now I go unto Jerusalem to minister unto the saints, for it hath pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints which are at Jerusalem. It hath pleased them verily, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles had been made partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister unto them in carnal things. When therefore I have performed this, and have sealed to them this fruit, I will come by you into Spain. And I am sure that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessing of the gospel of Christ. Now I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake, and for the love of the Spirit, that ye strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that do not believe in Judea, and that my service which I have for Jerusalem may be accepted of the saints, that I may come unto you with joy by the will of God, and may with you be refreshed. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen.
Okay. All right, we've been talking the last couple of weeks about the paper we're planning to file with the United States Supreme Court. And let me see if I click on it here to read it. There's two ways to get to it. On the front page, you can click on and get to a page, get some basic information, and also talks about our enforcement here. And this information was found on NORCOM's website. And I also give a link to NORCOM. Anyway, the writ mandamus, right now it's 218 pages. We have two more memorandums to add to this paper. One of them I finished today, and that was on family court, the disastrous evil family court. And the last one that I'll be working on is for the jury administration, right of the people, to orientate the jury and to handle the jury that... all these individuals that are government employees or even people that are appointed or elected, they should not be, especially Bar Association members, they should not be orientating our juries. Anyway, hopefully I'll finish that up tomorrow, and I should be able to then attach it to this paper, and it should be pretty much done. So today's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So Wednesday, I think, let's say, we should have it done, and it should be all posted. The entire paper should be up there. And next week, and I'm asking people to go out, take a look at that, read through it. Maybe they can comment on it next Monday. And I'd like to file it maybe sometime after next Monday. We still have to go through names on this paper. I know there are some names that are still missing. I do have a list of names that I have to add here. And I'm going to be calling for a special meeting maybe on Tuesday, Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern time in this room. That's kind of the plan. I'll send an email out to confirm that or change that day and time. Jan or Terry, do we have anything going on in the room on Tuesday? At 7 p.m., is the room open?
Isn't the prayer group on Tuesday night?
I'm not sure. Eric, is the prayer room on Tuesday night?
The prayer group is on at 9, I think, John, isn't it?
Is it at 9?
That's
just
correct.
Just a minute, I'll check.
9 o'clock.
Okay, so the room is open at 7. I'm not expecting to spend much time in the room on Tuesday. I'm going to be sending a note out, and then I'm going to confirm it. I'll probably send it out tomorrow after I finish the paper. Like I said, I have one more memorandum to write. And the one I just finished today, I need to go through it. I think I can probably get them both completed by tomorrow sometime, and let's say by Wednesday post it. And then so for next week, next Monday, I would like for anybody to make some comments on it, thoughts, ideas, corrections, anything really that they might want to think that we should even add. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there's another memorandum we should write. The key point to the memorandums ultimately is to really deal with every problem that prevents our courts from being courts of record, run by the people. There are a lot of more issues, but once we can get back a court of justice, then we can deal with all those other issues. And I think we could deal with them quite quickly. It's just a matter of writing the papers for each of the different issues. And I probably have a lot of information already collected and even written to some degree to write those papers pretty quickly and bring them into the court and to try to get it enforced. But again, it's going to depend on quite a few things, on when enforcement might take place. And how the United States Supreme Court is going to respond. But the meeting for Tuesday will be for the people who they don't see their name in the paper, and it should be in the paper. For instance, just to come down real quickly in a couple of pages, we give a list of all of the papers that are attached to our filing. And we're not going to, of course, attach all these papers to this particular paper. We've already got 218 pages and, let's see, 20, 30. I think it's going to be probably maybe 230 to 240 pages. Let me just make a note of this, 230 to 240 pages. Yeah, somewhere around there it's going to be. But all of these papers have been filed with the court. And all of them are up on our website at nationallibertyalliance.org. But these individuals that we've added to our cases on habeas corpuses, non-judicial foreclosures, indictments for denial, well, I'm sure they're not going to let us know that their name isn't here. But I think we're going to have some more names to add because I think we have some papers we've got to go through. And that's what I'm going to be spending the week on, trying to get this thing updated here as far as the names are concerned and see once where we're at with that. And then, like I said, hopefully by the following Monday, we'll make a filing. But I do want to time for people to take a look at it and offer their thoughts and corrections on this paper, anything they really think that we should add that we haven't put in. So hopefully that's going to be our discussion for next week. I mean, that's even could be our discussion for tonight to some degree if people have been looking at it. I've been updating this all week. So again, all but two memorandums are attached already. Okay, with that, Jan, do we have any questions tonight? Or any announcements?
Yes, we have about three questions for you tonight, John.
Right.
The first one, and I'm not sure how this was determined or what it really means, says, why did you remove Act of 1871-1877, where our U.S. government is a corporation that is overriding the 1776-1778 Republic American Constitution of Solvency?
Remove 1871, the Organic Act of 1871, right. I guess, what they're talking about. I don't know where they meant that we removed it.
Well, did you have it listed on the website or something and removed it or something? I can't understand the question.
We've had papers on our papers. I'm a papers to court, so you'll find specifics and details on that. As a matter of fact, sewn throughout this particular paper is the idea of the problem 1871. One of the memorandums of law deals with the abrogation of the United States of America. And we do have a memorandum on that, and that is in this paperwork as being a problematic problem. But I have no idea what that individual is talking about. Maybe there's something that was somewhere and somehow it got lost, and if they're more specific and we can find it, we'll replace it. But other than that, I don't know.
Hey, can you hear me?
Unfortunately.
Sorry. Hey, is he talking about, Jan, you need to read that again slower, because it sounds to me, he says, why did you replace it and overlay it with the Constitution? Sounds to me like he's saying, why did you throw out 1871? I mean, it sounds like
I can read it again.
A philosophical question to me.
Yeah, I understood
it right. Just go through it again slow.
Want me to go through it again?
Yeah, just do it one more time. Let me see what.
Okay, I'll do it slowly.
Okay.
Listen carefully.
For old men.
Why did you remove the Act of 1871? And I won't go into the other date. Where our U.S. government is a corporation that is overriding the 1776, 1778 Republic America Constitution of Solvency. So there's some confused dates there too.
I'm not sure what 1878 is about. Does that ring a bell with you, Gerard?
I'm sorry, John. I'm confusing it with the Judiciary Act, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
You might have the date wrong. All right, so it wasn't as he is saying, why did you take it out when the government is really a corporation? I understand.
Yeah, I don't recall
Did you take it out?
No, not at all. No.
I mean, we had it in there.
If you're talking about this paperwork, we did have something
on
here on that.
On the site?
Huh?
Is he talking about on the site?
I have no idea.
I assume that must be where it is, because nobody obviously removed it from the congressional record.
No.
Let me just take a quick look to see what
John, we have. Has the power to remove that act if it's in his writing. John, you better stop removing them things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you remove 1870?
Okay, let's see. On the site, so that could be it, but it's not that they necessarily disappear, they just change places, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm wondering.
I wonder why this thing is...
Well, look, the point is if you read John's paperwork, we say it in all our paperwork. It's
yeah, we do. It is so throughout a lot of stuff. We did have a paper, which is still up there, it was not removed, where we very specifically went point by point of the subversion.
We are on the right side of that issue, is what I would say. And like you, John, you were heading the right direction. It's mentioned in the paperwork all the time. So I don't know, if he's thinking that we're trying to hide the fact that the U.S. has put this fraud corporation over us, and that's how they're doing what they're doing. That's not the case when in L.A. We definitely know what that issue is. And it's even in our paperwork, like you said, John. So
here it is. There's a memorandum of law. It's 14 pages concerning the abrogation of the United States, an act of high treason. And this does talk about that issue. It talks about in 1876, the 14th Amendment, the 13th Amendment, and 1819 concealed. This talks about the concealment of the 13th Amendment, the original 13th Amendment.
Right.
But anyway, it goes into the issue of
the Judiciary Act.
It's the Organic Act of 1870.
Or the Organic Act, right, that actually made us a corporation.
And so it is, this paper does cover that in the paper, if that's what they're talking about. I might have worded it different from the past, but I don't recall so.
But if anybody's wondering about our position is that was a fraud, and we call it out. We call it out in some of the paperwork, the Corralantos and stuff that we put into the court. So there's no blurring of where we stand on that, where NLA stands on that. So if anybody's wondering where we stand, we understand that this is a fraud corporation. And no, that doesn't make us sovereign citizen or anything like that. That makes us students of history. Okay?
All right, and here it is. Pick it up here, the systematic destruction of America by enemies both foreign and domestic, and it starts off with 1871 and an act of high treason.
There you go.
The 41st Congress, steered by barristers, acted without constitutional authority, an act of fraud via the Organic Act of 1871, conspiring to subvert the United States of America by attempting to dispose our covenant with our Creator and thereby establishing a totalitarian government unaccountable to we, the sovereign people. They incorporated the United States under foreign control, behind which the conspiratorial erosion of our Constitution began. And, of course, they were doing everything they could prior to that. There was a lot of other things that were going on. And one of the biggest problems was the Federalist Movement. Not that the Federalist Movement was bad. It was never even called, you know, the original papers, the Federalist Papers, were not called the Federalist Papers at the time of the writing. But it was just, you know, putting the information out to the people as they were debating and talking and constructing and going through the Constitution. And establishing, actually, the work had, I'm sure, was already done at that point. The Constitution they had worked on and written was now brought up through the Federalist Papers for the purpose of debating, discussing, and confirming and agreeing on the issues. And by the time the end of that conversation took place, so to speak, there was already a movement because there was some deficiencies. Even though James Madison, who was working very closely with Jefferson, who was out of the country at the time of the writing and the debating of that, they had been working on that together for quite some time, and they were bringing up certain points that they were concerned about in the Constitution, and they were the instigators that really required and got, I don't know how many states really came up with, I forget the number of states, but they refused to sign without an additional information, which then was a debate or a conversation concerning the Bill of Rights, ultimately, which was the Anti-Federalist Papers. But the big problem, just like the problem today, you take the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party clearly has been infiltrated by enemies, both foreign and domestic. And their whole purpose is to destroy, and most Democrats don't realize, the regular people don't realize this, generally speaking, but, you know, the Washington Democrats, let's call them that way, they particularly, their purpose is to keep us into the idea or the mindset, and they worked on this going back 100 to 150 years, that we're a democracy, and to get away from the idea of being a republic. And as a matter of fact, if you really take a look at the law that was written, that we've already have written in the U.S. codes, what Democrats, their position and whole idea behind the Democratic Party and their push for the democracy is unlawful and it violates the law. I forget how many years, at least a couple of years in prison for trying to alter or change our republic. That was a big debate or a problem. But the thing is that they infiltrated the Federalists. There was a Federalist Movement, and the enemy, the banksters and so on, others, New World Order ultimately, they had infiltrated and pushed forward. And this was what Washington was talking about. He was talking about this particular problem. That they have created factions within us, and then of course they then turned around and said that as history goes, that Jefferson was pushing forward a Republican Party, and that wasn't true either, because none of our founding fathers were, or at least most of our founding, probably most of them, if not all of them, I think it was all of them, they were in one accord parties were a problem. We have a lot of quotes from our founding fathers concerning political parties, that they're not part of who we are as a people, and that they're destructive and only move to divide us. And we as a people, we need to get rid of these political parties. They got to go. Now, it's not going to be that easy to be able to say, to try to get that idea out. I think by actually through education will cause that fall away. That's the key, I think. And I did do a long memorandum on that particular issue. I did not add it in the case because I didn't think it was appropriate for the case, for the main reason that I didn't want to get into too many issues. I think there were 17 or 18 issues I got into on this particular paper. And every issue is really focused in on bringing us back to a just court. You know, we just want to get the courts back to where they belong. This is our big focus, And we don't want to get issues cluttering this paper or anything we're doing right now until we get the courts back open. See, once we get the courts back open and they're lawful and just and free access to the people, and where the people actually are running the courts, which is the way it's supposed to be, and that only the sheriff or the coroner can bring issues before the grand jury, until we bring this court system back to that construction, a constitutional, common law constitutional construction, let's say, until we can do that, we can't win any issue through the courts anyway. But once we do win that, then we can win every issue there and after. But anyway, it's important that we get as many eyes on this paper as possible to read through it and give us their thoughts and ideas, things that we may be missing. You know, I have, when I write, and I found this is an issue for a lot of people who write. You know, sometimes you're writing and all of a sudden your thought drops and you pick up a new thought and you get a gap. And it just doesn't make sense sometimes. And that's what I really would like people to be really looking for. I updated my Word, my Microsoft Word, and there's a lot of things that pop up that didn't pop up in my older Word. You know, a lot of different, like semicolons, commas, and different things. And I've been starting to see the logic of a lot of these things, so working on my punctuation, I guess you call it. And you know, we could take those corrections too, but I don't want to focus too much on that. I look a lot at our founding fathers' writings and the way they wrote, and a lot of their punctuations was not necessarily so good either. And that's true for a lot of people who write. You know, we try to get it as good as we can, but you know, I know I'm not an English major, and but anyway. As long as we don't hurt or injure the logic and flow of whatever is being said, and of course, punctuation does help that. You know, anyway, corrections. Anybody got any corrections? Go through this and let's try. Hopefully, we can focus next week the entire 2 hours just discussing this particular paper. And within a week after that, or sometime close or as soon as we can, we're going to file it. You know, the timing is not in our up to us. And, you know, I spoke about trying to file this before the end of the year. And then we came into the new year here in January, and we're still not finished. So clearly the timing is not up to me. The timing is up to really, you know, up to God, from my opinion. But it's up to getting it done and completed and then finally being able to file it. But anyway. Let's try to make that this the conversation for next week. Okay, where are we, Julian?
This is a memorandum of abrogation of the United States, right? In your case, right?
This is in the case. This is one of the filings, as a matter of fact. So let's go up here and let's see.
I just want to say something. This is a resource because in years come forward, somebody can grab this piece of paper and stick it in any case. It's already done.
Absolutely.
And so the other thing is this memorandum, this abrogation, this thing, the abrogation of a memorandum of abrogation in the United States, it should be as popular as that Brenson case. What the Brenson case did is it proved that the Supreme Court didn't care that the Congress committed treason. That was what that was to show us, because they said they weren't going to hear it. And I think they were told to say that because they want us to wake up and realize that. That was treason, because the Brenson case has, like this one does, evidence of treason by all of them, and it's cut and dried. Did you do that? What's the law? The law is this. Did you do that? No. Okay, so you broke the law. Simple. There's nothing to discuss. There's no opinion. And that's the way this paper should be, too. You see, they're opening our eyes to all this stuff. I mean, you know, what did you think when the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to refuse to hear it, after they instructed them on how to put it in and everything, like they were actually going to use it, you know, as a loaded gun against Congress to get them all taken out of office because Congress is mad at them because the Roe versus Wade. So this is a big game, but I'm just telling you that this paper here should be as important as the Brenson case, because the Brenson case showed us fundamental treason with no question. No discussion, you know, right out there in your face, you know. Anyway, I'm just saying that this should even go, you know, more viral than that, because you put this in, basically what it's saying is you're operating as a foreign country. You know, you're against the Constitution. This is important. This is where we're coming to. This is what has to be, this is what has to happen in order for us to return to the constitutional republic. So I could see this paper going down as a real resource, and it should be brought to the, you're going to send it into the Supreme Court. Are they going to hear it? I think we should push it that they hear it.
No, this is more than just hearing it. This is an indictment on the federal judiciary and potentially the United States Supreme Court. As a matter of fact, look at, people really should read through this paper very carefully, and they'll pick up on it very quickly. And people don't need any knowledge to read this, because it's all common sense. And it lays out, point by point by point by point, the destruction of our republic. And that's what this paper is all about. It shows that the total 100% destruction of our republic, and that you cannot get a court of law open in any of our courts through anywhere here in the United States. It doesn't matter what level you come in. You can come in at a village level, the town level, the county level, the state level, or the federal level. You will not be able to get a court of record open. And the idea of a court of record, you know, it really is sown also throughout all of these papers, you know, because from time to time the point is made, or some kind of a focus on a court of record, because everything is really, really talking about a court of record throughout this paper, the fact that they have taken and shut down our law. And how they abrogated the law, which is the most important point to be made here, is they actually, the United States Supreme Court, and you know, just came together in 1938 took the law and equity and replaced it and threw it out and just replaced it with civil law. That's what they did. And we are in civil law courts. And that's not a court of record. That is not who we are as a people. A civil law court is not protective of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights or our liberty in any way at all. Everything brings us back to the will of those who should be serving us, but now are ruling over us. And that's the point of the paper. I don't think they can. This is not a case that if they make the decision and go forward, and do what's proper, which is to write writ mandamuses to all 94 federal district courts, to all 17 or 18 points in this paper, to let it be known that this is the law and this is what needs to be done, because that's what we're commanding. We're not asking them. We're not asking them to hear the paper. We're not asking them to consider what we have to say. No, we are commanding them. There is no debate. The debate is over. The case is over.
You're not demanding them. You're requiring them. There's a difference.
Then requiring, if you want to put it that way, fine.
Right, but you can demand anything from the king, but you can require what he has to do by God.
Okay, so we'll require them to do what they have to do. They don't have a choice.
We are requiring them to fix this as we the people. That's a stronger thing.
Well, the interesting
thing. We're not praying the court anything. We're not praying the court. We're telling them, you move over because you're out of order.
Well, the interesting thing between this case and the other case, the Brunson case, you know, the Brunson case was focusing on political problem. This case is focusing on the judicial problem, and there are problems in both, and that's why, you know, I thought it was really great that they had gone and put that kind of a paper together to focus that way,
well,
and
were
at the same time coming in the other direction. Huh?
They took a lot of the politics out of it by focusing only on the fact that there was a law that Trump put in that said that within so many days you had to do an investigation. By the DNI, all the ABC agencies had to make a report that told if there was any hanky-panky in the election. And what happened is those heads refused to do it, and so they couldn't give that report. So when that report was not given, so actually the DNI said there was interference, we just can't tell you how much. That's it. Was there or wasn't there? And the law says that if there was reported that there was hanky-panky in the election, that you are required to stop the vote and do an investigation for 10 days. They voted not to follow that law. And that's what that Brunson case, it took out took out all the voter fraud, the machines, all that. They didn't talk about any of that. All they talked about was the fact about how they ratified the election when there were 100 senators that signed papers and put their hand up and said, I had problems in my district, and they said, we don't care. And that was the treason. And then they made more treason when they all voted not to hear the hundred, whoever it was, congressmen, senators.
Yeah, but, you know, bear in mind, though, you know, if I think that paper moved too quickly. And we're going to get to that point anyway at some point. But the bottom line really is if they would have been able to be successful, that paper, and clear out Congress, you know, there's a lot more that needs to happen. And that's why I might agree with you on the idea that they would kind of put it off
I think they were afraid to take Congress and the Senate out right now.
Yeah, it's not ready. There's too much to be accomplished. There's way too much to be
accomplished. And there's too many people not awake, and you could end up in a war, a civil war, or anarchy, or whatever.
Right, but the difference between that case and this case, remember, there are two power structures in the United States. That's all there is. It's just two. It's a political power structure and a judicial. We, the people, must control both. By not controlling both means that we're not having government by consent, and we never can have government by consent without controlling both of those pivotal points, those power structures. But you see, what we're pressing for really doesn't affect what's going on everywhere else concerning the subversion and trying to get the people to see it and so on and so forth. This in itself, people that do look at this will see the subversion. Also, it'll help to grow that point. But it won't change the landscape, so to speak, like the political paper there by the Brunsons, where they're looking to literally change the landscape. And we'd have a big, big problem, because now we're going to be, if they did get rid of all those individuals, we'd have a problem trying to get through what they're working on right now in Congress. And they're going to be addressing a lot of issues that need to come to the surface. These are waking up issues that are going to wake people up. They already got the interest of many people that weren't paying attention before, were watching the news maybe, but were never really paying much attention to what was going on in Congress. But now it's front and center. And it's the issue, and it's being discussed, and it's moving, and it's happening, and there's a lot of things happening there. So if they executed that paper and removed all those individuals, that would change the landscape in such a way, the political landscape in such a way that the necessary work could not be done. So I think that's a paper in the back burner.
I don't think there's anything wrong with getting rid of Schumer and Pelosi. You could change that landscape all day long, and it's only going to be better.
Well, that's true, but then you got how many people?
I'm going to have a vacuum.
Like 300 or 400? What was the number?
It's like 435 or something. And plus the
president. That's how many congressmen are there, but how many were they looking to remove?
Well, I think it
ended 300 and something?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, the point is, if they removed, let's say they removed 300 congressmen. Okay, you got 430, is it? How many congressmen are up there? It's somewhere around that number, 335.
We're only leaving about 120 people.
Well, I mean 435, yeah. So if you got rid of 300, you'd have 135 left. But the thing is first of all, it would probably all be Republican. I don't know if we'd find any Democrats in there to begin with, okay? And that's an off balance from the perception of the people who have not been woken up yet. I think the whole landscape, you see, really, I think what should have happened was they should have put this paper off to be looked at months down the line. And that's probably the issue that really should have been pushed, if that's what was going on behind the scenes, which I think probably was. See, our paper is going to be different. It's not going to affect the political landscape. It's not going to change anything that the common person is paying attention to, because really the only people that are really going to see this is the people who have been looking at the law, the people who are lawyers, particularly. I mean, the Bar Association is going to go through the roof, because we're telling them the Bar Association is a subversive group of association, and it was them. They're the ones that destroyed our republic.
If they adopt this paper, like if this paper gets put in and they actually go by it, the people are going to notice, because the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to give freedom.
But it'll, it'll be noticed in a different way. Yeah, it'll be revealing more, right, is what it would be.
It's more covert, and it's much nicer. It's a nice pill to swallow.
Well, yeah, it brings the covert problem to an overt position.
Right.
So, all right, okay, let's get through with a few other things, and we'll get to picking up, taking questions here. Let me get back. Eric, were we setting up, or did we have a meeting that I missed or something with GR and Mark? Did we have something set up?
I actually wrote to Mark today to let him know that GR intends to be there. The only reason he wouldn't make it would be his work with the South Dakota, I believe, legislature. He has a short window of opportunity, but he thinks he'll make it. It's going to be a week from Wednesday at 7:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's when we set it up.
Okay. So a week from Wednesday.
I believe that's the 25th.
25th. Let me look on my calendar here. Let's see, the 25th. Yeah, okay, the 18th is this Wednesday, and then the 25th is the next Wednesday. So 25th at 7:15.
Yeah,
okay, I thought I had missed that. I don't remember what, and I didn't put nothing on my board, but now I got something to put on my board, so I won't forget it, the 25th.
Yeah, good. I was going to send out reminders on Wednesday, but yeah, please put it down. And like I said, I wrote Mark today to let him know, but it's the first time I've ever reached out to him, so I haven't heard back yet, but that was just a few hours ago.
Okay. All right, sounds good. All right, I'm glad I didn't miss anything.
Yeah.
I've been so bogged down with this paper. I mean, nothing but this paper has been on my mind. But,
and you're saying
okay,
we're gonna look at this a week from tomorrow after next Monday's meeting?
This paper, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, this paper will be completed by, if not tomorrow, the following morning. I think by the end of the day tomorrow or the following morning, I should have this paper completed, as long as I'm not pulled out of my office here. Let me take a look on my schedule here, what's going on.
But you are referring to, you are saying that 7 p.m. a week from tomorrow.
Yeah, let me make it clearer, because maybe I don't think I was clear. Next Monday, I would like to focus in on this paper. People who are finding problems with the paper, people who find things that we need to add, anything that we can, that they might be able to be helpful to correct. Maybe some place where I wrote, you know, and my thought dropped and I picked up a new thought, and it kind of, it just doesn't make sense. Sometimes that happens. And
so is that our regular Monday night meeting, John?
Regular Monday night meeting. I just want to look at this. You know, I want people to be thinking about this, reading this, whatever they can. It's a lot to read. It's like a book. It's 218. It's going to be about 230, 240 pages, and somewhere in that neighborhood. But I will tell you what, it's a full education. It's an education of our court. I mean, a really good education of the court, because it really is trying to puzzle the court back to a court of justice. I mean, that's what we're working on. We're focusing in on all of the problems that have prevented us from getting justice in the court. And I think I'm pretty thorough on this. I don't know that I'm missing anything. And anything else that, you know, anything that we need to do to fix anything anywhere can be done through the courts once we get a court of justice back open, run by we the people, okay? And we have a U.S. Supreme Court that champions the Constitution and champions, you know, the Bill of Rights. That's what we need, and that's what we're working for. And we got a very serious consideration to take and consider should the United States Supreme Court do nothing. And the question becomes is how long do we wait before we see whether it does nothing? I am going to make contact with that general for NORCOM and see if I can't get a conversation on the phone with him, or I'll probably just do something, write him a letter or something first and then follow it up with a phone call and see if I can't get a conversation to see what their take is on all this, because we then have to make a serious decision. And it's the biggest decision I think we could make, and that is a consideration of an indictment on the United States Supreme Court, each and every one of them. Because look at least, you know, at some point in time, because they're going to get the paper, they're not going to be able to deny receiving the paper, and it puts it lays down the law for all of their clerks that they become guilty of treason if should they try to hide this paper. And again, let me go back to the top part of this paper, which is an important point to this paper, and that is, and I added this last week, it came to my realization, we're telling them this is in the United States Supreme Court, and we have a record, it's been on the record since 2015, this case has been going through, and now it's an indictment on the federal judiciary. Not necessarily that we're indicting every federal court judge out there, that's not the point. That's a decision that needs to be made by the people as time goes on. You know, all of the court cases that are going to at some point come up because of this, as we do the major changeover from civil law back to common law, I mean, it's going to be huge, and there's going to be so many lawsuits that are going to be coming up going after individuals. And we can't help that, and we can't, so we don't need to chase individuals, with the exception to the ones that we've already indicted, which is over 100 judges. But look, it's a national emergency concerning high treason. That's the very beginning right there. And we refer to 18 U.S.C. subsection 2382. This is the law. The reporting of this to a judge is the law, and that is the point. And then the two points I've made after, which were U.S. decisions, U.S. Supreme Court decisions of the past, judges have no more right to decline in the exercise jurisdiction which is given them to usurp that which is not given them. The one or the other would be treason, okay, to the Constitution. And the second, of course, is silence can only be equated with fraud where there is a legal or moral duty to speak, or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading. That brings them, okay, to jeopardy of being indicted. And there are two places within this paper that we put pretty strong language in there. You do the right thing or you're going to be indicted. And so if that's what we have to do, we have to bone up on this and get up and do what we have to do and consider an indictment on every single one of these judges.
Can I say something about this paper as far as the military and the Supreme Court and all that, the perspective here? Listen, this is a paper that's coming from We the People, and more than that, it's coming from We the People's grand jury. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're under, whether you know it or not, I believe we're under a military government, because I think that when Trump left, that's what he left us. Look, they asked Trump.
Well, that's what devolution is.
Right. So when the military was getting ready to step in anyway, and they asked Trump to run because they wanted civilian control. The president is the people, is the civilian part of the government. He's the civilian that's controlling that executive branch, as it should be. See, they didn't want to come in as the military, which they could have. They could have put us under martial law, and they could have done all this stuff, you know, using admiralty power, like what's his name talks about, the cowboy guy there. I'm having a senior moment. Where he talks about...
That Singer?
Huh?
That Singer?
Yeah. Come on, somebody help us out. Derek Johnson. Derek Johnson, that's right. He basically laid all that out, what they can do, you know, and then it's military tribunals, there's no baloney, but they didn't want that, because sometimes you go military, a lot of countries don't come back, and this country is stronger, but it's no different. So they were smart by asking Trump to come in, because they wanted that civilian control of the government. Well, that's what this is, and so the military is going to look at this, and they're going to like it, because it gets right to the point. And it's We the People saying it. So the military will back us on this, I think, okay? And maybe even push it, hopefully, God help us, right? Because that's where we're at, basically.
No, I think I might try to get the word devolution into this paper somewhere. I got to think about that and go through it to see if I can, you know, just something sort of a subtle, you know, softball to the court. You know?
Now, look, make no mistake about it. The Supreme Court committed treason by not hearing that Brinson case. That was treason. I don't give a crap. It's so cut and dry. Just like what you're talking about in this paper is treason. It's cut and dry. So
yeah, 100%.
That was the first paper. This is the second. This is 1-2 punch. Brinson went in. The Supreme Court showed their true colors, and I don't know if they were told to do it or what. Maybe they're under control. You know, I think the military. I was told that the military was talking to them. That was the intel that I got. that the military was telling the Supreme Court, you do the right thing because there's enough of them that have been compromised. They said, look, if you don't do the right thing, we'll come in and arrest you, hang you, whatever. So I got to believe that they told them, go ahead and vote it down because we're not ready for it or whatever. I mean, that's my...
This paper will not change the political landscape in any way, at least not very quickly. What it will do is give a new view to things that people have never looked at or thought of, have no knowledge of. And it's eye-opening because, you know, look at, read the Declaration of Independence and then read this paper. Brent is doing a course on the Magna Carta. And, just had the second one, the third one coming up this week. People should consider joining in onto that course. And you can get the past recordings also if you join in on that. And this paper rests on the Declaration of Independence and the Magna Carta. It's written in there in the main part of this paper. And by what powers and by what authorities and who we are as a people and how it was constructed. So that kind of language is sown throughout here. But I do want to try to get that word devolution in there some ways. And like I said, you know, the question becomes is how long do we wait before we decide that we have to consider an indictment on the United States Supreme Court? And if we do that, it's got to happen. At that point, these people have got to be indicted. They have to go to trial, and that's it. There's no getting away from it. Not that that would happen right away if they're still in control of the courts and if the enemy is still in control of the courts. But at some point in time, when justice prevails in a nation, and
or the military steps up and says, "Guess what? He's right. You're under this, and guess what? We're going to have a military tribunal."
Well, I think this will be an eye-opener to the military because I don't know if the military knows the law.
That's the point I'm trying to make, that this is maybe another twist more powerful than anybody realizes because they're looking for that civilian. They want us to wake up and put our two cents in. They don't want, you know what I mean? You can't expect the government to save the government. It has to be we the people. Mm-hmm. This paper is we the people.
And that is the key point to the whole thing, absolutely,
right.
By power and authority. All right, well, we can continue this discussion, but first let's see if we have any other questions. Jan, is there any other questions? And we're also looking for any kind of...
Yes, there are two more questions, John.
All right.
Next question. Last year, when I signed up with NLA to send my sheriff a book, Government by Consent / Constitutional Sheriff, there was a sheriff listed by name on the New York City .gov website. Now it's not there. I called 311 and per NYC 311 agent on 1/16/2023 use this address. Note the website no longer lists the name of a sheriff, a contact person, website, or a phone number available. And the 311 agent said that there is no further contact information. Office of the Sheriff, 66 John Street, 13th floor, between Judge and William Street, New York, New York, 10038. My question is, do you have the name of the New York City / New York County Sheriff, the man or woman or the name of a contact person?
Well, in reality, there is no sheriff in New York City. There's 7 counties in New York, 5 boroughs, and 2 other counties. The other county is Westchester County, and one of the counties out in Long Island. I'm not sure. I think it's Nassau County. So Nassau County, the five boroughs, and Westchester County have no sheriffs. Now, they may have a sheriff's office, and they may have been appointed. The question is who appointed them. It was done by county. All these sheriffs I have discovered, and I haven't got 100% proof or shall I say documentation on it, but I'm pretty confident that what I'm hearing is true, is that they got rid of these sheriffs through referendum. I mean, how do you change the New York State Constitution, number one? I did write a lengthy paper on this concerning the memorandum of law concerning the county sheriff, and that is one of the issues to be brought up into the court because we need our sheriffs for enforcement. And so, again, this paper, that's a good paper to read. It's pretty powerful, in my opinion. And in my research that I've done on this, it is clear that there is no common law without a sheriff. It doesn't exist because there's no enforcement at all. And I go through on this paper all of the different law enforcements, going to the FBI on the federal level. But all the law enforcements, whether it be a village, city, town, county, state, and then of course even federal, when you lay them all out, they all answer. They're all code enforcers to begin with. They're not law enforcers, number one. Any arrest that they make is made by citizen's arrest, no different than you and I could make, okay? They're controlled by a political animal. For instance, the state police is controlled by the governor. I presume that the sheriff's department down in New York City, there's five boroughs down there. But if there is a sheriff's department, it's controlled by a political animal, most likely the mayor. Yeah.
When are you going to write a paper suing them for calling these guys the sheriff? Because they're not. They're concealing the fact that there's no sheriff. The proper answer they should have given them, guy, not that there's no more information, but that we got rid of them.
Well, that's the very first. Once this paper goes through and we get some movement on this, that's one of the very first things we're doing. Matter of fact, that's my next focus, is working on sheriffs.
Look, it's fraud. To say you have an office of the sheriff and you got some appointed, federal dick in there, whatever they call them, so they're not telling the people we don't have a sheriff, because that would enlighten the people.
Well, I don't think people are knowledgeable enough to know about
if they went in looking for the sheriff's office and all the offices of sheriffs were closed, and you say, oh, no, we got rid of them by referendum. That would be a pretty good education for the public.
Well, yeah, you know what? The only thing, and this is important, I was wondering about this for a while until I started to do the research, was why our Constitution didn't give more of a focus on the sheriff. The point or the fact of the matter is it's a fixture of common law. The sheriff's office is a fixture of common law, goes all the way back, is attached from the very beginning. And ultimately it's attached to law to some degree of the king. Okay, and this actually goes all the way back to Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar had a sheriff, okay? He was his law enforcer. He made the law, of course. It wasn't common law. There's a couple of hundred republics in the world today, but there's only one common law republic, only one. We're the only one. And the sheriff attached to that, okay, that's the common law. It's a fixture. It can't be taken. And I realize, yeah, it's important that the only thing that a constitution should say about the sheriff, it can't detail anything specific because it's already in history, the power and the authorities of the sheriff. It's already there. It's written down. You can't shake it. You can't move it. Go to the Magna Carta and you'll see part of it in there. But the thing is that you can't shake it away, number one, but it's not right to do anything other than to put into the Constitution the election of the sheriff. And that's all you have. In the New York State Constitution, the sheriff shall be elected every 4 years. Okay? That's the only power or authority of the government to say anything about the sheriff, or the legislators, to say anything about the sheriff. So it's rightly so that it's kind of not in the Constitution. But it is in the history, and it cannot exist. It's a fixture that if you take that piece out, it's void, because who's going? You think some governor, some political animal that's controlling some police force somewhere, wherever you live, that they're going to be concerned about your unalienable rights? You think they're concerned about the Bill of Rights? You think they're concerned about, giving you your due process? Because the problem is, when you have a free and independent sheriff, and you have a free and independent, if we the people are free and independent, and we have free and independent juries, they're in trouble, and they got to walk a very fine line, because now, at that point, now you truly do have, this is where you truly do have the fear of the people. I think it was Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, when the people fear the government, you have tyranny, but when the government fears the people, you have liberty. And I look at all the things we've done, all the things we've looked at, all the things we've written about, all the papers we've done, the research, and it boils down to this very one thing that drives the fear of government of the people, and that is the right of the people to control the judiciary, to control the judicial, the law. Because there's no judge, there's a tribunal, and the tribunal is the people. Although a judge is a tribunal also, but it's for equity. But the tribunal is the people, and the enforcer is the people. It's a people's law enforcer. They answer to nobody but themselves. As a matter of fact, the sheriff should be interpreting the law. And even if it's an error, that's okay. He can have an error. The point is he could tell any judge and he could tell any lawyer, prosecutor, anything. He can say, no, that's not the way it is. This is the way it is, and this is the way it's going to be in my county. And if you don't like it, hey, tough. Take a hike. Who cares? That's the power and the authority of the sheriff. Now, he could be wrong, and he could be corrected, and if he needs correction, it should be brought to him and laid out And if he's true to his office, he should see the error of his way like anyone else in common law, because it's built upon maxims, self-evident truths, consistencies, things that cannot be denied. Common law is just logic is what it is. It's just laid out, obvious logic. Who could disagree with it, you know?
So but, it's like then, Scalia said with the common law grand jury. He said it's not mentioned in the Constitution, but it's this and it's that. And it's practically a fourth branch of government, even though it's not mentioned.
So well, you know where it's mentioned? You know where it's mentioned? It's mentioned in the judicial powers given to the Supreme Court, and that is law and equity, right there. And that law is common law. And believe me, I've gone through Black's Law, very specifically Black's Law, to find 51 jurisdictions, one of which is law. And the only law, L-A-W, capital L, left alone, not positive law, not equity law, not civil law, not any other kind of law with any kind of other word attached to it. Just the word law, L-A-W, is common law throughout the Black's Law. And that is the key. It's a fixture of common law. You can't shake it away. You can't sweep it under the rug. It can't be hidden. And again, I think I made a good case on that when I wrote that paper. It's 10 pages on the memorandum of county sheriff, and it's on this paper right here. You know, you got to find it. You got to go scoot your way down to find it, and you'll find it. But anyway.
So I still think it's fraud that any of those counties that don't have a sheriff have an office of sheriff.
Well, it's more than fraud. It's subversion. It's subversion against the United States of America. It's subversion against the people. It's subversion. And that is the very first, very, very first thing that I want to address. The next thing, as a matter of fact, I'll be working on those papers next. And the research necessary county by county. You know, we don't have any sheriffs up in Alaska. Never did. We don't have any sheriffs in Hawaii. I don't believe we ever did. We don't have any sheriffs in New York City, five boroughs, five counties. A borough is a county, plus two, so there's seven altogether. We have no sheriffs in Connecticut, and there's a few other places we don't have sheriffs. I got to go and look into it, because I do have some notes on that somewhere. I just got to look for it. But I think I can Google a lot of this stuff and find it. And dollars to donuts, you know, in Connecticut, how'd they get rid of the sheriff referendum? Westchester County had to get rid of sheriff's referendum. New York City had to get rid of sheriff's referendum. It's going to be that way all the way through. The only difference is a place that where they came in late, okay? You know, and I saw that was being a problem. A lot of the later states are really tainted with a lot of garbage because of the New World Order, and they're coming in late, you know, like, Alaska and Hawaii came in the 20th century? So they became states. I think it was 1950 when Alaska came in as a state, if I recall, in the 50s, early or 40s, somewhere around there. But in any event, those states never had sheriffs. Go ahead. Someone wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think it was 1959.
59? All right, thank you. So anyway, that's the next thing we're going to be focusing in on. And once we get a court of law opening, we're going to be pushing that and going after these counties where they have to now get a special elections going immediately to elect sheriffs. And we will, you know, you know, those will probably be the strongest sheriffs coming in because they'll know how it was enforced and how they're running for it, that it was, you know, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury that put that in place. And we will definitely get books out to those individuals as they take their offices. Of course, we'll be depending on people to be given money. You know, we're out there looking for money because really to hit that critical mass, we need money. I'm already talking with our web designers or maintenancers or whatever you want to call them, you know, and what we have to do next to kind of do an upgrade to be prepared for a, you know, a large group of people coming in, critical mass. And if we hit critical mass, I mean, I'd be so bogged down, I don't know what I'd be able to accomplish without a paralegal and a secretary. And I am working on that with somebody who thinks they might be able to help to get us some money. So, and anybody else that thinks they can help to get us some money, you know, I sent a paper out to one of the richest people in the world asking them for assistance. I mean, $1 million to them should be nothing, absolutely nothing. It's like a couple of hundred to us, you know. But in any event, you know, the nation rides on this. Our common law, our courts of justice, you know, it's riding on this getting done. And so we hit critical mass. We don't have enough volunteers to be able to handle critical mass. And we're counting on something to happen somewhere to give us, maybe a critical mass will bring in the money. Maybe critical mass, you know, if 100,000 people all of a sudden pop in and realize what we're doing and understand and want to support us, you know, $5 a month from 100 people, I mean, a 1,000 people or 100,000 people, because we're looking for critical mass. We have 10,400 something right now. But if we had 100,000 people who are really interested in saving this nation and put their money where their mouth is and where they, you know, put it out there to support us, that's $500,000 a month. I mean, that's a huge amount of money. And we'd have to give accounting of that money at that point. You know, when we start to make big money, we'll have a page of accounting to lay out what money's come in and what's being used for and so on and so forth, put it all out in the open. I mean, right now, we don't make enough money to even deal with that kind of a situation. We're just bare bones. You know, I get some help from NLA to support them. But at the same time, you know, I get $1,200, $1,500 a month coming in from my books. And that goes right into NLA. And it works to support NLA. You know, most people are giving us $5 a month, and that's good. You know, with 10,000 members, we should have $5 a month from half of those people, let's say. And that in itself is a huge amount of money. It's at $25,000 a month. I mean, we'd be able to get people on salaries, go professional, and really get some work done. And we're not talking about people pulling, you know, $250,000, $300,000 a year out of this. We're not talking about anything like that. But we're talking professional salaries, but nothing crazy. I mean, look at the paperwork that we do and have done would be millions of dollars if it was done by lawyers, okay, who would never write the way we write anyway. But, you know, we do it for nothing. We do it because we know we need to do it. That's why we do what we do. So, you know, anybody that's not given, please give to National Liberty Alliance $5. Give up a cup of coffee. Give up a bagel. Once a month, that's all. Once a month. Just give up a coffee and a bagel once a month. That's $5. That's all it is. I mean, that's nothing. And anybody that's got deep pockets, this is where we save America, right here. This is it. This is the issue. There is nothing more important, save bringing forth the gospel. There is nothing more important in this world today than to save this republic. And there is nobody that really can save this republic but the people themselves. And the only way they can do it is by coming educated, getting involved, and taking control of their government, the two structures, the power structures of this government, the political and the judicial process through the committees of safety. That is it. There is no other way. You know, Trump can do all he wants. He can bring all the military together, and he can give the nation back to the people after he put all these people at the end of a short rope or in jail or whatever the case may be here. And some of them just removed. I don't know. There's different degrees of their crimes. But in any event, he could do all that and give it to the people. But if the people are unable to receive it and the people don't know how to receive it, We'll only find ourselves back here again. It's only a matter of time. Because the hearts of men is desperately wicked. Who can know it? You know, we have to have self-control. And I notice a lot of people don't have self-control. You know, we have to have morals. And I notice a lot of people don't have morals. And that is the destruction. And that's why our education is so important. A good education, a full education. And our children must know who the king of the court is. And when they learn who the king of the court is, they're going to learn morals. They're going to learn right from wrong. They're going to learn what justice is. And that's a necessity. And you don't have to be a Christian to be part of that. You could be an atheist. It's really the principles that the king has brought to us. That is the key. And every man can live with that, and every man can agree with that, because God put it into their hearts to see that. You know, you go back 1,000, 2,000 years, the hearts of men were a different focus. Indeed, God did make a change in man's heart after the cross. It was a huge heart, and a huge change. And he said he put it into all men. All men know. You know, all men know. And you can't run away from it. But anyway, let's get back to the whatever questions we have left to answer. Any other
John,
questions?
Quick note, it looks like Brent came in.
Oh, good. How you doing, Brent? We'll pick up Brent in a few minutes then. And Gerard, once we move over to Brent, you take the controls?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be here too, but I'll probably leave at about five before the hour, because I got to go pick my son up. But what other questions do we have here?
We only have one more question, John, and then there's a short announcement I'd like to make too.
Right.
So your last question is, I have put in several constitutional challenges in various cases, from mortgages to traffic violations, but they all go ignored. The question is, how do you enforce a non-response or default to my constitutional challenges?
Well, if you look at this paper right here, just take a look at us, okay? Look at all the papers we filed, and what did they do? Right here, same thing, ignored. We filed habeas corpuses, what did they do? Ignored them. We filed the papers concerning non-judicial foreclosures, what did they do? They ignored every single one of them. They ignored. They'd done nothing. They responded to nothing. You see, this is, and we purposely have been doing this because we knew what they were going to do. We've been in the courts before we started writing these papers. We saw how they were responding, what they were doing. They have no respect for our Constitution, no respect for the people of this United States. They don't care about your rights. All they care about is filling their pockets with money and power and having authority over you. Okay, they don't want to give you justice. They don't want you to stick your nose into their courts, and they're not going to answer you. They don't even obey their own law. They are totally lawless. Even to their own law, they're lawless. They don't care. So we have the same problem. We all have the same problem. Now, there are ways you can get some things done. I mean, we took this path right here to do this. We did this to get nails in their coffin. Ever since 2016, papers in the courts ignored. Papers in the courts ignored. Papers in the courts ignored. People going to jail, doing habeas corpus, ignored. Homes being taken, they ignored. Take their home, put people in jail, do whatever the hell they want. And they've done it. And we've put it on the record. And it can't be erased. It doesn't matter what they do. It's there. It's in numerous places. And now it's going before the United States Supreme Court. And let's see what they do, if they're going to ignore it. You know, we've come to the end of our rope with this, and we are relying on NORCOM to do what has to be done, and I'm very confident of that. But if not, then the people have to do what they have to do, and that will come at a time when it'll be known at the point of time when people have to do something. Right now is not the time, but at some point in time, if it ever comes to it, we'll know when that time comes. It'll be obvious. It'll be as obvious as it was to our founding fathers for the first shot fired. We'll know. But in any event, the thing is that they ignore us. But there is ways to get through this. You know, I've won some cases. I've won an IRS case. I'm in the courts again with helping someone else to do an IRS case. I'm going to probably go in and make the argument for them. My first challenge is they're going to tell me I can't. And I'm going to tell them I can. But you know what? we discovered some leverage. And one of the most powerful leverages that we have is if you're in a court, you give them a quo warranto. I will never walk into a court of law ever again without a quo warranto in my back pocket with the names of all the officers in that court. And the moment they violate any of our rights, any of them, that's when you serve the quo warranto onto the judge and onto all the officers of the court. They have 10 days to respond to that quo warranto. If not, they lose their office. Well, they'll ignore that too. Well, we run it up the line, and we do it again and again, all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. Whatever is required, that's the only way you're going to get enforcement and get anything done to not be ignored. You know, again, you have to have knowledge. You know, we've been in the courts and we've lacked a lot of knowledge. Knowledge, every time we go into court, we gain more knowledge. I feel I'm at a point where I think I got some really good strategies and kind of puts their hand behind their back their arm. And we've already had some things work. One of the things is to reveal the fraud on the paper. And you start off with signaling it. Okay, that's how I won my IRS case. Well, this next IRS case is a different case. We're going right for the jugular. We're putting it right onto the paper, clear as a bell. No one can misunderstand it. Anybody who doesn't even know the law could read the paper and understand and see the fraud and what goes on and how they played this game and how the whole thing is just a setup. You know, the IRS just appeared in 1970 or 71, the early 70s. The IRS all of a sudden just appeared as a government agency. Okay, they weren't there before. Alcohol, tobacco, the ATF. Okay, is an arm of the IRS. It's not a government agency. You can go search everywhere you want. You're not going to find it as a government. You may find it listed as a government agency, but you'll find no legislative authority making it a government agency, or any government power. Just like the Federal Reserve, it's a facade. It's the name of the game of the words. Federal Reserve, must be the reserve of the monies for the people, for the federal government, for the people, you know. Well, it's a game they play. Again, a facade. It's not real. It's not there. It's a fiction. It's a de facto. It means they have power. They have authority. But you know what? When you pull the curtain back and you reveal the wizard, okay, and the people can see, that's when they lose their power. And that's what you have to do in court at some point in time. But if you do that, you have to understand the game. You have to understand what is going on. You have to understand how they're going to respond. And that takes experience to some degree. But it also takes the knowledge of the process, to how this process works, how due process works, how the papers work, how everything flows and works together, and all the requirements of different things and your causes of actions being detailed out in a proper fashion. I mean, there's a lot. It's really not difficult. It sounds difficult to someone who has no, you know, doesn't know anything about these things. But like anything else, you spend your time reading and looking and thinking, and you say, oh, this stuff is pretty simple. And you know what? The great thing about common law is you don't have to have much memory because it's all common sense. It's your argument is a common sense argument. And in common law, it's all about the facts. Okay, so you don't have to have much knowledge. I mean, it's good to have knowledge, of course, of the founding fathers and a lot of very powerful Supreme Court rulings and different things of that nature. You don't have to have the knowledge of U.S. codes and statutes and regulations. You don't have to have that knowledge. That knowledge is necessary in other places, in equity courts, and people need to go to school in order to have that knowledge and be able to represent whoever they're representing in that particular code. For instance, you know, you have the president has lawyers around him that is very understanding and knowledgeable of the code that controls him. I think it's USC 3, if I recall, or 4, somewhere. It's one of the earlier ones that controls the president of the United States. It empowers him and gives him certain powers and authorities. Okay, but we don't have to know those things. We just have to know the facts. Give me the facts, and you can win any case. They can use their law. Let's look at the facts of the law that they try to use, particularly IRS. Go down the rabbit holes, and the whole thing is nothing but a facade. It is nothing there. There's no authority, nothing anywhere. even in the lies, they didn't even put enough lies in there to make it look like they had authority. It falls apart two levels down very quickly. Falls apart.
We learned that the congressmen and senators believe that they're immune. That was the only defense they put forward in the defense. That we're immune to that. You can't prosecute us. You can't kick us out. Now, I think that thought goes even deeper. I think some of these judges that know more, they think we're under this Emergency Wars Power Act, and so they're not giving us our habeas corpus and stuff because as far as they're concerned, we're under a military rule, and that's suspended.
And they think that's going to save them, that civil law that defrauded us.
That's what they're resting on.
And subverted our nation.
This case you're putting in, that's going to be their answer to you, John. We're immune to that.
Well, we cover that too in there. So, I mean, it doesn't matter because the revelation of what's going on and what they've done and the evil that has taken over is clear. And like I said, you know, lawyers have a hard time with this because it's so contradictive to everything they think and do. Remember, you know, bar attorneys particularly, and they're brought into these schools and they're indoctrinated into this craziness. And so you have 18-year-old kids. Someone needs to be... silence, they get some crazy noises coming through. But anyway, you got an 18-year-old kid. I mean, think about your mindset when you were 18, 19 years old. I mean, we were just nothing but a dumb box of rocks. I mean, you know, most of us anyway. The thing is that you're open to suggestions, and you're coming in and you're spending thousands of dollars for an education and they're teaching this stuff. It's got to be true. It's costing me money. The courts are being moved and the process moves along and the knowledge of things that take place is you're getting it in the schooling, so it's got to be real. And then all of a sudden we blow their world apart with a common law paper. It just blows them out of the water, you know. So they have no background in the common law. And you know, I can only think of them just being confused and frozen like a deer caught in the headlights. I mean, they just freeze and what the heck are you, what, you know, and they can see the truth to some degree, but their brain won't allow them to have it because they've been making money. They've been working in the system. They know how it works. We're stupid. They're smart. They got the whole thing figured out. They're the ones that control everything and they know it. And then all of a sudden this comes in. And they don't know how to, they can't comprehend it. They can't digest this. It's like the darkness comprehending the light. It can't happen. You know, when God said, let there be light, and the darkness comprehended it not. I mean, that's how it is with these people. And unless you get a lawyer at a young age, or you get a lawyer that has actually been taught truth outside of the bar, particularly, because there are places where you can get an education as a lawyer, and I don't know how much they teach them about the common law, but it's difficult, I guess, for them to even bring it into the courts because the courts, look, at you can't become a judge unless the bar approves it. Now, I don't know if that's in every state, but generally it's in most states. Any bar-controlled state, you know, that's it. You're not getting approved as a judge unless the bar approves you. And you do something outside of the norm, you're going to find yourself out of your judgeship real quick. So they got lots of problems in this. And, you know, the bottom line, they need to leave the bar. And that's where we're heading for. They don't belong in our courts because they're subverters. They're taught to destroy. And this started in 1750. This goes all the way back into the colonies before we even became a people together as the United States, when we were colonists. In 1750, the king sent over bar attorneys for the sole purpose in order to destroy a common law republic because they were having problems and Benjamin Franklin was a real pain in the rear end to them. And they had to do something because they couldn't get the colonists under control, you know, generally speaking, anyway. So people need to fix it. And the only way you're going to get it fixed is to get educated and organized and to get involved in a committee of safety and take control of the two power structures, judiciary and political, and take total control of that because that is our right. That is our heritage. To have government by consent is the foundation of America. The first paper that created who we are, the Declaration of Independence, that's the foundation of who we are as a people, a covenant with God, and government by consent, the necessity. And when they go up against that, they're not only going up against the people, they're going up against the Creator. Because no one can break that covenant. No man can break that covenant. No man. Without paying a price. You know? Any other questions, Jan? Is that it? Did I... we finished with questions?
That's the last of the questions, John. I did have a short announcement I'd like to make.
Go right ahead.
It concerns the Reawaken American conferences. They've been going on for several years now. They travel from city to city. And they're hosted by General Flynn and Clay Clark. And they have a group of approximately 40 people that travel with them. And these people are... state-of-the-art people in different areas, like in COVID and so on, and legal issues and all that sort of thing. The next one is in Nashville, Tennessee, this weekend. That's January 20th and 21st. And if you're within driving distance, I would suggest you go. I've been to one. It was great. The next one scheduled is for May 12th and 13th, and that's to be held in Miami, Florida, at the Trump Doral Hotel. Next one after that is August 25th and 26th, and that's in Las Vegas, Nevada. That'll be at the Trump International, Las Vegas. These are an easy way to get a tremendous background in a lot of different areas that you really need to know about, even if you don't think you do. I would strongly recommend that if you're anywhere near any of these, that you attend. There are links on the top of the newsletter every week under announcements that you can click and get information on any one of these. So hopefully some of you will take heed and check it out. And that's all I have, John.
Okay, thank you. All right, we're going to move over to Brent, and after Brent, we'll take a few questions. There are two people in the queue, so we'll try to at least get to those people, maybe. I'm going to pass the controls over to Gerard. You got him?
Yeah, I should have him, yeah.
Okay, do you want the desktop, too? Well, if you want the desktop, you just knock me off.
Yeah, I just click on it, yeah.
Yeah, so that shouldn't be a problem. Yeah. I'll just put our front page back here, and that'll be what's up. Brent, are you ready to take the mic for a short?
Yeah, I'm on here.
Okay, it's all yours. This is Brent Allen Winters. He's a common law lawyer and author of the book, and quite a few books, but one of them is The Excellence of the Common Law. Brent, you got the mic, and his website is commonlawyer.com. You got the mic.
Thank you, John. And Gerard, good to talk to you. You're there, aren't you, Gerard?
Yes, I am. Good to hear from you, Brent. Have a long time.
Good to talk to you, Gerard. Hope all's well with you and yours. This is Brent.
Oh, by the way, before you get going, Brent. Brent, before you get going, I should be finished with this paper I mentioned to you before. I'll drop it off into your Skype maybe the day after tomorrow or tomorrow. I should be finished with it, and I'd like to get your feedback on it. It's a long paper. I mean, it's going to be like 230 pages, like a book. And I'm not, you don't have to read through it. You can skim through it, and I'm sure some places you might stop and look here or there. But I want to get your opinion on it. And, you know, you got a lot of experience in the court. You can maybe give me some thoughts and ideas what you think their impression might be even. So, okay?
Well, all right. I look forward to seeing it, yeah.
Great. You Thanks. Got the now. Thank you.
This is Brent, and a while ago, John was talking about habeas corpus, so I said, well, there's no way we can not talk too much about that and on this particular Monday night call. There was a time when a lot of attention was given to it. It still seems to be elusive to people, what it is and how it works. So what I'd like to do here, instead of saying this is what it is and how it works, I want to read the story of a real live case that really happened. And I've probably told this before, but I was in a courthouse not too far from where I'm from. It's been for near 15 years ago now, I guess. And there was a fellow there. I was in the I was looking for a deed in that room that they've got in the center of the courthouse. It's got steel all around it. It's an old courthouse building, and there's usually a room in those old buildings where they keep the public records of births and deaths and marriages and land transfers, deeds. And I was in there, and there's a fellow in there with a camera, and he had a piece of old book and paper laying out on a table, and he was trying to take a picture of it, and ask him what he was doing. He said, well, this here is a declaration, the court's declaration for freedom for four slaves, no, five, four children and their mother. Her name was Mary Bryant. She had four children. And the court declared them released after friends of theirs had filed a habeas corpus. A petition for a habeas corpus writ. That's really what it is. You request the court to issue a writ, that is a command. A writ is an old common law word meaning command from a greater to a lesser. And so if you know somebody's in jail or you're in jail, you file this paper with the court and you request that the court issue a writ to the jailer, whoever the jailer is, to bring you in front of the court and prove on good evidence that he's jailing you lawfully. Now, the habeas corpus can be issued against a jailer, like a sheriff. It can be issued against a federal prison warden. It can be issued against a hospital who is holding somebody in their room against their will. It can be issued against any private party that got somebody held. And it's all about false imprisonment. This fellow was taking a picture of this order. And I said, well, what's the significance? It was from, I believe, the year 1843, and it was in the document room there at the courthouse. And it was issued in a case in which Abraham Lincoln defended a slaveholder. Abraham Lincoln defended a slaveholder by the name of Matson. Now, I've got a section in the book, Excellence of the Common Law, on this case, so I'm going to read some of these words here, or just talk through them, whichever is easiest. Then this is to help understand what habeas corpus is. It was the case of James Somerset. That happened in England. It was a case of a slave from Virginia here in America, and the slaveholder went to England by ship, and he took the slave with him. His name was James Somerset, the slave's name. Well, when he got to England, and no James, he got rabbit in his blood, and he took off. He said, this isn't slave country here in England. It's against the law, so I'll just take off. You don't tell me what to do anymore. Well, he put in a complaint with the court, and they caught James Somerset there in England and jailed him, waiting further disposition of the court. And eventually he was released on the doctrine of free soil. And the doctrine of free, it's a common law doctrine. What it says is that if your foot touches the soil of that island where England is, the you're ipso facto forever free, regardless of the former condition of your slavery or servitude. When your foot hits the soil, your chains fall off. That's the official doctrine of our common law. But what the Englishman didn't understand was that that didn't just apply to the soil of England. That was what their doctrine said. No, it applies to all land on God's green earth, because all land belongs to him. And that was the idea behind the doctrine to start with, but they got kind of exclusive about it, and they said it doesn't apply in America. Well, in this case that Abraham Lincoln was in, the court ruled it also applied in America. It's called the free soil doctrine. And Abe Lincoln's experience with habeas corpus was pretty extensive by the time he became president. And this is one of the cases he had where he argued on behalf of the slaveholder to get his slaves back. And it provides an informative informative story that teaches what habeas corpus is. And that's how I found out about it, was being in the courthouse where this really happened. And this piece of paper this fellow was taking a picture of was the order from the court to discharge, order to the sheriff of the county to discharge 5 former slaves following the Coles County Court's issue of the writ of habeas corpus. I'm reading now from this section 3.8.13.1 from the book Excellence of the Common Law. And the order showed, and in this proceeding, the slaveholder, Robert Matson, had asked the sheriff to find, arrest, and hold his runaway slaves until he claimed them back as his property. And Abraham Lincoln represented this slaveholder by the name of Matson, with the M as in Mike. At that time, Matson owned a plantation in Bourbon County, Kentucky. And each spring, he and a few of his slaves crossed over into Illinois to work a farm he had purchased above the Shelbyville Moraine in Coles County, where the dirt is exceedingly black and rich. And after harvest in Coles County each year, Matson and his slaves returned across the Ohio River to their domicile in Kentucky. Year-round, however, Matson employed one of his former slaves, Anthony Bryant, as a permanent resident, watchman, and overseer of his farm in Illinois. Because Bryant was a domiciliary of Coles County, Illinois, as a matter of Illinois law, he was a free man, but he never knew that. Bryant's wife, this man who was the caretaker, he was a slave, then he had a wife. I said Mary, her name was Jane. I got that wrong. Her name was Jane. Was a temporary resident on the Illinois farm each year from planting to harvest. And she had intent to return to her home in Kentucky because her master would take her back there come fall of each year with her 4 children. Therefore, many believed she remained a slave in the eyes of Illinois law because she was not a domiciliary. In other words, she was not a permanent resident of Illinois. So the common belief was, since her husband stayed there year-round as caretaker of that farm, he wasn't a slave as long as he was in Illinois. But she was, because she would come there and leave. Now, see, these questions had never been settled in America, and that became a very much of a sticking point for a number of decades before the northern and the southern tiers of the states went to war. Well, people said the soil of Illinois was free soil. Of course, the people that said that said all soil is free soil. It doesn't make any difference what land you're on, according to the Bible. Well, while in Coles County, during harvest one year, Jane, that's the slave woman with the 4 children, Jane Bryant, she fell into an argument with Matson's Irish housekeeper, Bridget. Bridget was the name that a lot of Irish housekeepers have. So they called them Bridgets because there were so many of them that had immigrated to America, so many young girls, and they all had jobs being housekeepers, that people just called them Bridgets because so many of them had that Irish name, Bridget. And he had an Irish housekeeper, which was cheaper than having a slave, by the way, because there were so many Irish immigrants at that time. But she got into an argument with this slave woman, and the Irish, the Bridget, as they call them, threatened to urge Matson to ship Jane back to Kentucky or perhaps sell her down the river deeper south, because this Irish housekeeper apparently thought she had something going on with Matson. And the two women don't get along well in the kitchen, and so that's kind of what happened. They got in a fight. Well, fearful of the housekeeper's sway over Matson, Jane Bryant's husband, whose name was Anthony Bryant, found refuge for his wife, their 3 daughters, and their 1 son with a fellow by the name of Gideon Ashmore, a local innkeeper, 6 miles east of the county seat, but 8 miles south of where they were, near Oakland. Matson, having learned that Ashmore had given his slaves refuge, appealed to Ashmore to return Jane Bryant and her children to his farm. Ashmore, By the way, there's a settlement there of about 200 people where Gideon Ashmore had this hotel, and it was a stagecoach stop. But now it's just a little town named Ashmore, named after Gideon Ashmore, who built the hotel there, or the inn, as they called it in those days. Matson petitioned the Coles County Court and Sheriff for the return of Anthony Bryant's wife and children. Sheriff Hutchison responded, discovering Jane Bryant and her four children had been taken from Ashmore's Inn and were hiding at the home of Dr. Harum Rutherford. He was a medical doctor that lived in Oakland. By the way, his house is still there, and it's the nicest house in town. It's a pretty big two-story frame house, but it's kind of fancy. And his name is Rutherford, and he was very much of an abolitionist in a world of copperheads. And most of the people that lived around that part of the world at that time, they were immigrants from Kentucky, including Abraham Lincoln and his wife, Mary Todd, from an influential family in Lexington, who were good friends with Henry Clay, and Henry Clay was Speaker of the House of Representatives. Well, Rutherford was a sympathetic soul there north in Oakland, and he had the woman and her four children. Forthwith, Hutchison, sheriff, arrested Jane and her four children and jailed them at the county seat, and he awaited further directions of the Coles County Court. Now, Mr. Ashmore, Gideon Ashmore, believing Jane and her children were free as a matter of Illinois law, filed, here it is, a petition for habeas corpus on behalf of the Bryants in the Coles County Court. Petition for habeas corpus. You see, habeas corpus is a writ, that is a command, that the sheriff would issue, or the court would issue to a jailer. And so if you want the court to do that, you file a petition for habeas corpus. That means you're asking the court to issue this writ of habeas corpus, commanding the jailer to bring the jailed, the body, that's what habeas corpus means. Habeas corpus is Latin for we have the body. Bring the body of the jailed person in question before the judge. Why? That's a very important part of our common law tradition, that they bring it before the body personally before the judge. Why? So if the judge rules that the jailing is illegal, then that person, without another moment delay, is released on the spot. False imprisonment is important to us in a common law country for one simple reason. And this is the reason behind our hatred of false imprisonment, or at least one time we had it. I don't know how people feel about it now. They don't seem to care much. But we had a hatred for it. Why? Because it's what the Bible commands, and it commands it to our grandpa Adam and our grandma Eve, when the Bible says, be fruitful, multiply, fill what? The land. Fill it. And he says, then take dominion over the land. The command we learn from Jesus Christ later is to not take dominion over other men. Now, Jesus Christ said that's what the pagans do. They dominate each other. That's what the law of the city does. It teaches that you must dominate the other fellow. And Jesus Christ said, the greatest among you shall be your servant. Do not be as the heathen who dominate one another. Well, then, if we don't dominate one another, what is it we're supposed to dominate? And the answer is the land. And if men would pour their energy out, dominating, bringing under control God's creation, his land primarily, then there wouldn't be time nor reason to expend energy trying to dominate your neighbor and take whatever he has. And that's the way all of the world fundamentally operates, unfortunately. But there are those few who are enlightened and don't do that. And they defend what they have if they have to. You defend your land, but you don't go dominating other people. That's what you don't do, and you'll pay a price if you do it, and countries that do it will pay a price too, by the way. That's why false imprisonment is so wrong, because if you're imprisoned falsely, friends, then you're mitigating against God's command to dominate on impulse, to occupy, as Jesus Christ said, that's the word he used, occupy land. Occupy until I come, he said. occupy it, bring it under control, according to his terms, not yours. He's the landlord. But that's the ultimate reason behind our common law's hatred of false imprisonment, and the reason that Parliament, in the year 1679, I believe, Parliament fashioned and passed the Habeas Corpus Act. Now, don't say that our common law is never legislation. No, sometimes it is. Sometimes the legislature gets it right. And by the way, when legislatures do that, we're happy for it. It's never a pretty sight, and it's usually there are a lot of people there trying to do the right things for the wrong reason. There's just a lot of shenanigans going on. I remember reading about when Parliament passed the Habeas Corpus Act. You see, Habeas Corpus, and our Supreme Court said this, Habeas Corpus didn't give any new idea. It just gave a handle to a very old thing they'd been trying to figure out how to enforce for a long time. How do you keep false imprisonment from happening? Habeas Corpus gave a tool to us to keep it from happening as much, to question it. And when it did pass, they were a couple of votes short. And the way they used to do it, they'd send the members of Parliament outside the room, and if you voted yes, you came back inside. If you voted no, you waited till everybody was inside that voted yes. And instead of having the confusion of trying to count raised hands and people arguing over whether or not this guy's hand was raised or it wasn't, or only half raised it and somebody didn't see it, they developed this habit where they, this custom where they go outside to take the vote, and you voted by coming, if you voted yes, by coming back through the door, and there were a couple of men standing at the door, and they'd count who came back in, how many votes there were for yes, for the passage of the bill of habeas corpus. Well, they didn't have enough votes, and the two fellows that were standing at the door were for it, the two counters, after they came in. And one fellow came walking in, and I just remember his name, or maybe it doesn't make any difference, but he was rather portly. I mean, he was a fat man. I mean, really big. And one fellow looked at the other one standing at the door and said, "That guy there is worth two votes just looking at him." And so they counted him for two votes, and that's how habeas corpus passed, and we've enjoyed it ever since. What'd they do? They cheated. That's what they did. But they declared it passed for whatever reason. So don't complain about the intentions of men who passed legislation or the ones who ratified the Constitution. We know there were scoundrels there. There always are. But God do work, to quote Gary Cooper, God do work in mysterious ways. And he gets what he wants using anybody he wants to use and using any method. He's sovereign. He can do that. We don't have that option. If it happens, he certainly allows it. Well, Matson wanted his slaves back, and so the friends of the court filed a petition with the court, requesting the court issue a writ, that's a command to Sheriff Hutchinson, to produce Jane Bryant and her four children before the court to show the court a lawful case for holding them in jail. Well, the habeas corpus hearing was called, and Dr. Rutherford, that's the man having provided refuge for the five slaves, Jane and her four children, and he was a longtime friend of Abe Lincoln, by the way. See, Lincoln's mother and father lived right in that county there. By the way, Abe Lincoln's mother, the county prosecutor here, who became later on, during the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt, he became Speaker of the House of Representatives. And if you go to Washington, D.C. today, the large office building with all the offices of the congressmen are is named after him because he was Speaker of the House for a long time and very powerful. His name was Papa Joe Cannon, they called him. He was congressman from right here in Coles County. And his favorite line, he was a pretty good guy. His favorite line was, he's best known for saying, "This country don't need no more legislation." That's just the way he said it. This country don't need no more legislation. Well, he arrested, he didn't. The sheriff arrested. Didn't arrest her, but this guy, Joe Cannon, prosecuted Abraham Lincoln's mother Sarah Bush for shoplifting on the courthouse square. The feelings ran so strong, Copperhead feelings, around that courthouse, that during the war, a terrible riot broke out, and Union soldiers on leave at home got into a terrible fight and a riot on the courthouse square, and 8 men were killed. Sheriff was killed. A ball, somebody fired a horse pistol, and the ball went through the window of the sheriff's office and killed him. No doubt somebody was aiming at the sheriff. It wasn't Hutchinson, because this happened before that. But Lincoln, Madison, or the slaveholder, Rutherford, Doc Rutherford, on behalf of the slaves, sought Abraham Lincoln's services in representing the slaves in this case. But Madison, the slaveholder, had already talked to Abe Lincoln when he rode into town on his old gray mare that he'd rode around, had already asked Lincoln to represent him. But he didn't. Rutherford. So Madison released Lincoln from confidence because he had talked to him. That's the way it was. But Lincoln didn't take the case, so he wasn't allowed to take the case for... I've got it backwards. Excuse me. This is lawyer stuff, all about confidences and conflicts of interest. Madison knew Lincoln had talked to Rutherford because Rutherford was his friend, and Madison said, "That's okay. I'll waive the fact that you did talk to Rutherford about the habeas corpus." In other words, his opponent. "I'll waive that. I want you to represent me," because there wasn't enough lawyers to go around. So Lincoln, with another lawyer by the name of Linder, represented the slaveholder, Madison. And by the time Sheriff Hutchinson responded to the writ of habeas corpus, and of course the writ was written to him, commanding him to bring the five slaves before the court, the case had by that time garnered a lot of press, and there were no internet, television, radio. People were looking for excitement, and on the day that something happened to the courthouse, everybody from the county was there. And everybody from the county was there. And so Supreme Court justices from the state Supreme Court, a fellow by the name of Wilson and another by the name of Treat, traveled down to the courthouse to set as judges on the county bench to consider the matter, and Sheriff Hutchinson, having now brought the Bryant family before the court gave hearing, heard arguments, and then ordered the release and perpetual freedom of Jane Bryant and her 4 children. And this piece of paper that this fellow was photographing when I was there, that was the name of it. It was an order delivered from the judge for the perpetual freedom, it said, of Jane Bryant and her 4 children. I'm going to read to you what this order says. This was issued on the 16th of October, 1847, and it's called "In Certification of Freedom from Slavery." Here's what the court said, I'm quoting: "Now, at this day come the said applicants, and presented by Gideon M. Ashmore their petition for the writ of habeas corpus, directed to Lewis R. Hutchinson, Esquire, Sheriff of Coles County, who held them in custody, and the court, being satisfied in the premises, ordered the said writ to issue, returnable forthwith, before His Honor, Chief Justice Wilson, assisted by the Honorable Samuel Treat, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and the said writ having been returned, and the said Lewis R. Hutchinson, Sheriff, having made return of the prisoners upon the said writ before the court, of the causes and capture and detention of the said Negroes into court, and the cause coming on to be heard after testimony adduced, an argument had, and the court being satisfied what judgment to render herein, it is finally considered and adjudged that the said applicants, Jane Bryant, Mary Jane Bryant, Mary Catherine Bryant, Sally Ann Bryant, and Robert Noah Bryant, be discharged from the custody, as well as the said Lewis R. Hutchison, as of Robert Matson, and all persons claiming them by, through or under him, as slaves. That's a lot of legal jargon, wasn't it? And they be and remain free and discharged from all servitude whatsoever to any person or persons from henceforward and forever. It is further adjudged that this proceeding be certified to said Negroes as evidence of their freedom. And the said Sheriff, Lewis R. Hutchison, having returned that said Negroes retained by him upon proceeding instituted by the said Robert Matson as the owner of the said Negroes, it is further ordered and adjudged that the said Robert Matson pay all costs due and owing by the reason of the original arrest of said Negroes, including the cost of this application and the execution issue from this court. And I copied that direct from the original document in the courthouse. It was written out in longhand. Of course, they didn't have typewriters. Well, the case is all the more significant in that it occurred before the passage of the controversial Fugitive Slave Act that, in theory, preempted Illinois law from granting freedom to slaves taking up permanent residence in Illinois. Some northern states, using the doctrine of state nullification of laws deemed unconstitutional, refused to acknowledge or enforce Congress's Fugitive Slave Act. Note well, slave states never used the doctrine of state nullification of federal law to enforce slavery, but the non-slavery states used nullification against slavery. Well, this is what happened. Now, Lincoln's friend and opposing counsel, O.B. Ficklin, he represented the slaves. Charles Constable's closing argument, according to Ficklin, was powerful, making Lincoln wince in court. And invoking the spirit of British law in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, Constable argued that Congress intended the soil of the Northwest Territories. See, the Northwest Territories are all the land north of the Ohio River, but a good share of that land had been part of the land grant of the colony of Virginia. And the Northwest Ordinance was put in place for that territory after our separation from Britain, in response to Britain having made all that land part of Quebec up north of the Great Lakes. And by the Quebec Act, Parliament had extended the boundary of Quebec in Canada clean south of the Great Lakes to the Ohio River, and by that act gave the French-speaking people up there the canon law of the Church of Rome as their law. And that's why our Declaration of 76 says that the King and Parliament, really what it was, have established a foreign law to our common law in a neighboring province with the intent of extending that law into these colonies. Well, that's they were talking about the province of Quebec having its boundaries extended to the Ohio River and the canon laws of the Church of Rome applying there. And so the Northwest Ordinance was written specifically for that area called the Northwest Territories to make it abundantly clear that this is a common law territory. And it says right in the preamble that the course of the common law shall be observed, and especially that that right of an inestimable worth, that's a big word, trial by jury shall be preserved forever. Well, Constable echoed the common understanding of American lawyers and judges of that day, including Ficklin, Lincoln, Linder, Constable himself, all knowing full well Lord Mansfield's finding in the Somerset case. That was the case where the slave from Virginia was freed on a writ of habeas corpus in England. and the first edition of Blackstone's commentaries, you see, it was analogous to the Somerset case. In the Somerset case, a slave from a slave territory, or a slave jurisdiction, Virginia, he wound up in England, and he said, I'm free. Well, by analogy, Kentucky was a slave state. Slaveholder Matson took his slaves over to Illinois to farm their farm across the river. And the argument was, well, then they're free. See, free soil doctrine. Same thing. Well, in Blackstone's commentaries, in the first edition of Blackstone's commentaries, here's a quote. The spirit of liberty, said Blackstone, is so deeply planted in our Constitution and rooted in our very soil that a slave or a Negro, at the very moment he lands in England, falls under the protection of the laws and with regard to all natural rights becomes eo instante, that means instantly, a free man. That's a quote from Blackstone. And Constable's argument, supported by Ficklin's argument, carried the day. And here's what they said, and then I'll stop. John, was that you? You started to say something, or Gerard, or somebody? No. Here, I'll make this quote. I speak, this is a constable arguing for these five slaves. I speak in the spirit of the British law, which makes liberty commensurate with and inseparable from British soil, which proclaims even to the stranger and sojourner the moment he sets foot upon British earth that the ground upon which he treads is holy and consecrated by the genius of universal emancipation, no matter what a man or woman's complexion. No matter in what disastrous battle his liberty may have been cloven down, no matter with what solemnities he may have been devoted upon the altar of slavery, the first moment he touches the sacred soil of Britain, the altar and the god sink together in the dust. His soul walks abroad in her own majesty. His body swells beyond the measure of his chains that burst from round him, and he stands regenerated and disenthralled by the irresistible genius of our common law. That's the argument, that's the record of the argument, the words he said in the little unknown county court in Illinois, comparing the Northwest Territory to be free soil, just like England. Well, I'll stop there. It's a fascinating story. That's how it happened. There are others here that I have that are well known and just as instructive, but thank you so much, John and Gerard, for letting me say a few words. And I'm giving it back to you. I don't hear anybody, so I guess if nobody's there right now, maybe I'll put everybody to sleep. I can keep talking, maybe. Should I keep talking? Are you there, Gerard?
I don't know. Yeah, we're here. I was just waiting for Gerard to come back.
Thank you, Brent.
Oh.
I feel more free now.
I get encouraged reading these words, and they need to be. Words are powerful, Gerard. You know as well as I do, and as Disraeli said, is it any wonder that men govern by words? God governs by words, and we're made in His image. So I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you. Well, it's after 11, so unless we got something special, I'm going to sign off. I think we had a very good meeting tonight. Learned a lot of stuff, and we're not going to stop learning. So, may you live in interesting times, right, Brent?
You ain't a kidding. Yeah.
So, God bless everybody. Come back next week, and we'll continue on. Thank you very much. Let's stop recording.
Good night, Gerard.
Good night. Good night, Brent. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, John and Terry and Dan and everybody else that helps keep us going.